from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. After all the storm and fury, a bill to reopen the U.S. government, lift the debt ceiling, and avoid American default passed by a wide margin last night. First the Senate, then the House.
The yeas are 285, the nays are 144. The motion is adopted.
The 11th hour votes brought an end to the bitter 16-day shutdown and standoff that brought the country to the very edge of its full faith and credit. It's being described as a nearly unconditional surrender for the Tea Party hardbars who look to shut down Obamacare. But it's a short-term deal. This hour on Point, the deal: American democracy, and what now? You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What have we just learned? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Everybody debating the meaning of what we've just been through. Here's two Republicans, House Speaker John Boehner on WLW in Cincinnati yesterday.
Listen, we've been locked in a fight over here trying to bring government down to size, trying to do our best to stop Obamacare, and we fought the good fight. We just didn't win.
The good fight, says Speaker Boehner. On the Senate floor yesterday, Republican Senator John McCain.
We are now seeing the end of this agonizing odyssey that this body has been put through, but far more importantly, the American people have been put through. It's one of the more shameful chapters that I have seen in the years that I've spent here in the Senate.
Good fight, shameful chapter, and that's just Republicans. We'll get an estimate of the economic impact of the near default and last night's deal in a moment. But first, joining me now from Washington is Molly Ball, staff writer covering national politics for The Atlantic. Molly Ball, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you today.
Hi, Tom. Great to be here.
And with us from Washington, Roger Simon, chief political columnist for Politico. Roger Simon, greetings. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
Molly, I mean, at this point, I guess we've all heard the deal. Is there anything in the deal that we don't know about? I'm reading here this morning Mitch McConnell got a $3 billion dam in Kentucky for his assent to this. Is that right?
I don't know all the details on that, but that does appear to be the case. There are some things hidden in the deal. One of the interesting thing was that even at the time that the Congress was voting on this late last night, reporters still had not seen the actual paper copies of the legislation. It was drafted in such a hurry. So, of course, that always creates room for mischief, always creates ability for lawmakers to insert pet projects in there. And McConnell now is already being attacked from the right for this supposed giveaway, which I'm sure we're going to hear more about. And you know, Mitch McConnell, I think, is the one who had the most to lose on both ends of this. On the one hand, he's got a tough primary against a Tea Party opponent, and that was clearly part of his calculation in not being part of the deal-making process early on. On the other hand, he's got a tough general election against a pretty well-pedigreed Democratic opponent, and you had to think that at some point, with how Republicans were tanking in the polls based on the shutdown, he started to think that was more of a danger to him and he had to come to the table.
The real basics here, what, the government shutdown wrapped up but only until January 15th. Debt ceiling has got some flexibility in it but only until February 7th. An agreement, I don't know if it's in the bill or outside the bill, to talk about these things and try and get some kind of deal on the budget before December 13th. None of that gives us a very long, I don't know what it is, running room, runway, gangplank, you name it, Molly.
Well, yes, but at the same time, let's remember that what originally shut down the government, the continuing resolution that the House failed to pass, was only for 6 weeks. So this is actually twice as long now as the continuing resolution they were initially going to pass. It actually gives Congress a fair amount of breathing room compared to what they expected to do in the first place, which was quite short term. And just speaking as a, you know, Washington reporter, would have ruined Thanksgiving for all of us.
But attention span of a flea. Roger Simon, has the chemistry changed on the back of this collapse of the defunding or delay Obama effort and this deal? Has the chemistry on Capitol Hill changed?
No, and I think people outside of this town see the whole last 2 weeks and the result as virtually demented. None of it makes sense. None of it was necessary. As John McCain later said last night, it was the wrong fight in the wrong place at the wrong time. It's everything that Custer would have said at the Little Bighorn. And we didn't, America didn't get much out of it. The Democrats got about 99% of what they wanted, I can see why Mitch McConnell, we were just talking about the Senate Republican leader, got such lavish praise from Democrats last night. It's because he gave in on virtually everything. And so we really see a Democratic Party that is victorious, but it's only victorious through, as you pointed out, January 15th for the budget, February 7th for the debt ceiling, and a Republican Party whose image has really been shattered and whose approval levels are at historic lows. And ironically, the people who caused it, the Tea Party members of the Republican Party in the House, are the least vulnerable in 2014. They're all going to be reelected. They got elected by huge margins. It's other Republicans who may suffer from this.
I'm trying to figure out, we'll look at the details, but if somehow the chemistry changes, though, I mean, this was, no matter what you think of it, and the stands people took, this had to be a stern lesson. But here yesterday on the House floor, this is Representative Paul Brown, Tea Party member from Georgia, saying, keep up the fight. This was yesterday.
I urge our House leadership and my colleagues to stand strong and to have what many of my Senate colleagues do not, the courage to oppose any deal that does not defund and delay Obamacare for all Americans now.
So, Roger, here we are. I mean, I'm reading Rich Lowry, editor of the Conservative National Review, calling this the defunding debacle. This is a very conservative guy. You know, quoting Napoleon, never do what the enemy wishes you to do. Quoting Sun Tzu, avoid what is strong to strike what is weak. This sort of long, strategic takedown of the whole effort. And yet, you've got Ted Cruz saying this was the right thing. We're on with it. You heard Paul Brown there and others. So does the chemistry change? Does the Tea Party leverage diminish after this shellacking for now?
I don't think so, especially if Speaker Boehner keeps his job, which I guess he's expected to. Ted Cruz got up on the Senate floor and said, the people will rise up. Excuse me. He said, you know, Washington is a broken place. Nothing good will come out of Washington. The people across the country must rise up against Obamacare. And so the whole shutdown was shutting down government, threatening the world markets in order to keep basically 12 million Americans from getting health care that they got anyway, and that a shutdown did not prevent. That's sort of the senseless nature of it. But as you say, Tom, the chemistry is still there. The Tea Party is still committed to defunding Obamacare. They voted, I think, over 40 times to do so. And I expect them to keep doing so as 2014 unrolls.
And yet, Molly, surely people have taken lessons from this. Is there not somehow a cooler heads scenario that emerges out of this? Maybe in the next 6 weeks before this December 13th deadline. You know, President Obama says, I'll talk, though, you know, he didn't want to negotiate under the gun. But he says he'll talk now. Republicans still have things they want. They just made a deal. Is it possible that we can get back to a more traditional give and take that gets American policy into at least an unharmful mode, Molly?
Well, hope springs eternal, Tom. I agree with Roger that the basic contours of the dysfunction have not been extinguished. And it is certainly true that the Tea Party's ardor has not cooled, that Ted Cruz and his wing have not changed their tune. But I think what might change, and we don't know enough yet to know whether this will be the case, but what might change is how Speaker Boehner deals with that faction, whether he feels that he has shown them that their way is not effective and that his speakership, therefore, will not be threatened if he proceeds along more pragmatic lines and uses the what appears to be a minority of his caucus to make deals across the aisle and to try to improve the image of the Republican Party, make it more pragmatic. I think the other thing that changed over the course of this debacle is that what was once a sort of cold war among Republican factions has become a shooting war. And it's now very clear who's on which side. And where Republican leaders used to be able to say when reporters said, well, what about these divisions in your caucus? Or these divisions within the party, oh, that's a Democratic talking point. Don't believe it. It's not true. We're very unified. I don't think there's any question now that that is the case, that Republicans are really divided and at war more with each other than with their Democratic opposition.
Roger Simon, you're very tough on the GOP in this, but do you have no empathy for Republicans who were saying here, we've got to make a stand somewhere. We want to get this country's finances in order. We don't want to be a Greece. Does that resonate nowhere with you?
Oh, no, I have empathy and sympathy for those people, and I believe those people probably deserve to be reelected. You know, Barbara Boxer said again yesterday, what did the people do to deserve this? Well, the answer is we elected some bad lawmakers, or quite a few of them. And if we continue to do that, nothing will change. The word heard most in describing the federal government, especially Congress, month after month, is dysfunctional. The only way we'll get a functional government and Congress is to elect new members of Congress.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the shutdown behind us, the default bullet dodged, what we've learned, where we're headed the day after the deal. Roger Simon is with us, chief political columnist for Politico in Washington. Molly Ball is here, covers national politics for The Atlantic. We'll hear in just a bit from Greg Ipp, U.S. economics editor for The Economist, on the economic impact of all this. I want to look at both parties. Republicans first. Here they are, two voices. Ted Cruz first yesterday before that Senate vote. The Texas Republican calling the fight against Obamacare, saying that a victory had been achieved.
We saw the House of Representatives take a courageous stand listening to the American people that everyone in official Washington just weeks earlier said would never happen. That was a remarkable victory.
A remarkable victory. But his Republican colleague in the Senate, Kelly Ayotte of New Hampshire, is saying here, I hope we never do this again.
You can be against Obamacare as I am. I am for repealing it and replacing it. But shutting down the government was not a smart strategy and not the right direction. And I hope we never do this again.
Molly Ball, you say it's not a cold war in the GOP anymore. It's a shooting war. How does this play out? John Boehner, where does he stand now? And this whole relationship between sort of middle and right, how does it work out in function, Molly? Does it change?
Gosh, I wish I knew. But it will be really interesting to watch now because there has been some kind of reckoning within the first of all, within the House Republican caucus, and also in the broader dynamic of the sort of regrouping and rebranding that the Republican Party is trying to do in order to try to win national elections again, which is another issue that Republicans are very concerned about, the sort of damage that this has done to their brand. John Boehner sort of faces a choice, as he always had. He has, in a way, called the bluff of those who threatened his speakership. If there's even among the Tea Partiers in Congress who are trying to now spin this shutdown as having been a productive exercise or a win for them and Obamacare on on the retreat and so on, they're mostly praising Boehner for sort of letting them have the fight and letting them give it a try and saying that they'll keep up the attack. So if anything, you know, this idea that he would immediately be defrocked upon making any kind of deal has been discredited a little bit.
I mean, Roger Simon, you're very tough on John Boehner and Cruz, for that matter. Your column this week said if Ted Cruz and John Boehner were both on a sinking ship, who would be saved? And your answer, America. But did John Boehner, I mean, he's the speaker. He's got to deal with the realities in his party. There was a strong faction here, not a majority in numbers, but strong in impact. Did he have to ride this through with them, the Tea Party caucus?
Well, that's why leaders are called leaders. You don't run for and become the Speaker of the House if you're not willing or able to control the members of your caucus. A caucus has to mean something. And it is clear from this, and I don't think John Boehner is a bad guy. I don't think he's an extremist. The joke that you accurately read from my column is an old joke that's been used for years. Democratic names have been plugged into it over the years, and Republican names have been plugged into it. But John Boehner's not a bad guy. But in this case, he proved himself to be a very weak guy. He did not want a government shutdown, but he got a government shutdown. He did not want to hold the nation hostage to the debt ceiling and a possible default, which he knew would be disastrous for the global economy. And yet that is exactly what happened. And unlike the last government shutdown, which I was around for, what nobody knew really.
17 years ago, yeah.
Yeah. No one really knew whether Clinton would be blamed or Gingrich would be blamed. I mean, there was polling at the time, but polling, there wasn't the mania for it that exists now. But this time around, the Republicans knew they were going to get blamed. They were the ones shutting down the government. And to no good end, since the shutdown of the government did not halt Obamacare.
So functionally, what changes here, if anything, Roger, in the way Capitol Hill, the Republicans on it, we'll look at Democrats in a minute, but on the GOP side, what changes functionally with this?
Optimistically, you would get more members of the House who are Republicans saying, look, we were elected to do something, and Democrats too, but this was a Republican shutdown. We were elected to do something. We weren't elected just to block things. The members of the Tea Party caucus really believe it is more important to block bad things, tax increases, expansion of government, Obamacare, rather than pass good things. So if you can get a number of people, hopefully with a message that's been being sent by their constituents this weekend, to say, look, we elected you to do stuff.
Maybe they didn't. I mean, maybe they elected them to block what they see as bad things, period.
And clearly, in those districts where Tea Party members were elected by large majorities, that's what will continue to happen. But there are some people on the bubble, some people who went along with the Tea Party because they feared that their voters might be swayed by the Tea Party and want a movement that was farther to the right than mainstream Republicanism. If members of both parties are really, this sounds Pollyanna-ish, but really see compromise not as an evil, but as a fundamental tool of democracy, then I think that's the only structural hope we can hope for.
Of course, you've got a faction here that sees the country as fundamentally on the wrong track. That's what the Tea Party's all about. They want to move that. And this time they didn't. But does that go away? Jill in Rhinelander, Wisconsin. Jill, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just have a question. I would like to know if those people in our federal legislature are going to be getting their automatic raise after the way they have behaved. I don't think they deserve it.
And do you distinguish, you know, this one deserves it and this one doesn't, or a pox on all of them, Jill?
On all of them.
On all of them, period. No raise. I'm sure they'll get it, but we got your sentiment. Thank you, Dave in Menominee, Michigan. Dave, you're on.
Hi, thanks, Tom. Mm-hmm. You know, we've heard from ever since Reagan that the government can't do anything right. You know, government is the problem. We've heard that over and over and over again for decades.
A lot of people believe the government became too big. They don't want that much of it.
Well, you know, this fiasco that happened here brought down the approval rating of Congress so far. And Republicans suffered the most, but they accomplished everybody else getting pulled down, too. And that, I think, is a reason why Republicans do think this was a success, They don't want people to trust government. They don't want people to think that government can do anything right. And so these kind of tactics in the long run serve their cause.
Well, that's interesting. But you think Democrats really have nothing to do with their own low standing in with the low standing of Congress, Dave?
Well, I think that this Congress has lurched so far to the right that the people who are in the center are now considered left, and people that were on the left are considered extreme left, where they when they haven't moved at all.
Well, I get what you're saying, and certainly Republican numbers at historic lows in polling. Democrats not doing so well in the midst of all this either, though, from what I can see. But I appreciate your call. One more right here. Williamstown, Massachusetts. David, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm a longtime listener, and I have to admit, in the last week or 10 days, I've been really disappointed with the makeup of the shows. I think they've been unbalanced. One of your guests just mentioned before how low the polling numbers were for the Republicans. Last week, Major Garrett, thank God, was willing to point out quickly that the president's numbers were quite low as well.
Mm-hmm.
I'm 51, self-employed. I consider myself an independent voter. I voted for the president the first time. I didn't vote for him the second time because he didn't come through on his promises, everything from closing Guantanamo to not continuing signing statements to televising the health care debate and so
yep.
on and so forth.
Yep.
And so, you know, what I learned something from this. Even though I'm not a big Ted Cruz fan, I tuned into his talk on the floor late, and when he read that letter from organized labor, I was really floored by that. We've got all of these exemptions and so forth, and the thing is that the president has submitted budgets to Congress. Congress doesn't have a budget, so you can't have these fights except during these continuing resolutions. And I'm calling from the shadows of Williams College, and the Senate mm-hmm. historian was here not too long ago,
mm-hmm.
and he spoke about how the complexion of the Congress has changed, and you have it's a pox on both their houses. They're so divided. When the filibuster rule was changed many decades ago, back in the 60s, it was lowered, that the Republicans acceded to it, knowing full well that the Democrats had already the votes, even at the lower level, to cut off filibusters. But they never thought in their wildest dreams that all the Democrats would vote together or all the Republicans would vote together.
And here we are.
Yeah, exactly. So my point is, and you've got all these exemptions. One of the things, I was for a full public option because I was so fed up with the old system.
Of health care, yeah.
And now there's all of these extensions. And I came around to feeling, after seeing what Ted Cruz spoke about, that we deserved an extension as well. I don't have much health insurance. So, you know, someone might say, well, gosh, what are you complaining about? I'm concerned about the long-term prospects of this country and the long-term debt situation, and how now, by many cases, I think including the Congressional Budget Office, our long-term debt is now equal to or exceeding what we produce economically, the value of that in this country.
David, we've got the whole line of concern, and I appreciate your call. I'm glad you're listening there. Let me pick it up. And Roger, I'll give it to you. You know, on the one hand, David says, why be so critical of Republicans in all this? On the other hand, you know, look at everybody's role, and people say false equivalency. What do you say to our caller, David, when he says, you know, this pox, and Jill as well, this pox on both their houses idea?
Well, there's certainly enough pox to go around. There are certainly, before this crisis, some Democrats didn't act any better than some Republicans. But in examining this shutdown, for these reasons, what they got out of it, to me, the conclusion is inescapable that this was a Republican shutdown that served no purpose, that only damaged America, and that even from the beginning of it, they had no end game. They had no victory. Ted Cruz, John Boehner, Mitch McConnell, what was their victory going to be? That the president would somehow throw out a law passed by Congress and approved by the Supreme Court because the Republicans didn't like it? It just made no sense to Americans, and that's why the numbers are so low.
Rich Lowry saying the same basically today in National Review. Of course, he's looking for ways to fight on. We're looking at the shutdown behind us. Let's look at Democrats for a second. On this side of this crisis, now resolved at least for a minute, here's a range of voices. We'll start with Anita Lowey. She joined us yesterday talking about the deal here, but she was very hard on Republicans on the floor of Congress. New York Democratic Congresswoman Anita Lowey.
I urge the majority to learn the lesson of this irresponsible shutdown. Do not allow the fringe in your party, those disconnected from reality and whose sole goal is obstruction, to continue to dictate the agenda of this House.
Sort of twisting the knife there. The president, in his press conference after the Senate vote last night, saying again, willing to work with anybody.
I've said it before. I'll say it again. I'm willing to work with anybody. I am eager to work with anybody, Democrat or Republican, House or Senate members, on any idea that will grow our economy, create new jobs, strengthen the middle class, and get our fiscal house in order for the long term.
Maybe that's going to require a different posture in the weeks and months ahead. Here on the floor of the Senate last night, Democratic Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar saying that the resolution to this crisis showed the new importance of being willing to work with political opponents. Here's a Democrat.
I think it shows what courage is going to be in the next year in this chamber and in the Congress. It's not going to just be standing here by yourself making a speech with no one there. Courage is going to be whether or not you're willing to stand next to someone you don't always agree with for the betterment of this country.
Stand next to someone you don't always agree with. Molly Ball, is there room for people to stand together like that in this debate over spending and, for that matter, health care?
Well, look, you hear a lot of Democrats sort of spiking the football today because they did win this fight. And yep. So, you know, that when she's saying people should stand together, she's saying Republicans come stand next to me. And what I think remains after all of this sort of dust has settled is that the basic irreconcilable policy differences between the two parties haven't gone anywhere. Even the Republicans, who consider themselves pragmatists and consider themselves constructive and don't just want to burn the whole place down and didn't think that the defunding Obamacare strategy was workable, they still feel that there is absolutely no way taxes should be any higher than they already are, or government spending should be any more than it already is. And if anything, it needs to go in the other direction. Democrats are saying there's no way government should be any smaller than it already is, no way taxes should be any lower than they already are, and if anything, they need to go in the other direction. And those are irreconcilable points of view. So when they go to this budget conference, which Democrats have been asking for all year and Republicans have not wanted to participate in because they see any deal-making as potentially falling down on their principles, when they go to this conference, I think they're going to have the same problem that the super committee had 2 years ago that came out of the last debt ceiling crisis, which was just the irreconcilability of those two positions.
What about Republican interest? I mean, we'll ask Greg Ipp of The Economist in a minute, but big business, U.S. Chamber of Commerce came down strong against default, certainly, here. I mean, maybe there's a new urgency on the economic side. This is a constituency of the GOP whispering, come on, guys, let's be practical, get something done so this economy can come up, Molly.
They're not whispering anymore. They are actually shouting. And that will be an interesting that will be interesting to see if Republicans do heed the views of big business. Because you have some Republicans say, ignore it, we've got to be a party that is more populist against Wall Street. But when your donors start talking, most politicians tend to listen.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the shutdown behind us, the default bullet dodge, what we've learned, where we're headed the day after the deal on Capitol Hill. Roger Simon is with us, chief political columnist for Politico in Washington. Molly Ball is here, covers national politics for The Atlantic. Lots of response online. Saturnine says, we're going to do this all over again. Round two, Tea Party has learned nothing. Only hope for stability, a wave election. I wonder. Creeker says, we get to pay $24 billion to allow 16 days of posturing from a small group in government. Talk about entitlements. But Marion says, I disagree with the Tea Party, but I think they did something good. She writes, when I became an American citizen, I was reminded how our duty is to participate in our democracy. I hope they reminded Americans that they must vote and participate more. Let's look at economic impact. Greg Ipp joins us right now, U.S. economics editor for The Economist. Greg Ipp, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you.
Hi, Tom. Good to be here.
Immediate impact, long-term impact of this shutdown and near-miss default.
The immediate impact will be relatively mild. You can see that from the fact that the stock market has more or less regained all the losses that it suffered during the shutdown period. I think that in terms of the overall impact on the economy, we might see a fourth quarter growth rate that instead of being, say, 2 or 2.5% will be lower by perhaps half a percentage point. And that reflects the fact that a lot of federal employees were not working, so their output will not be counted, and that some businesses that depended on the federal government, such as restaurants and hotels that are near national parks, will also lose business. A lot of that we will get back in the first quarter. So, for example, as the federal employees who are furloughed get their delayed paychecks, they can spend money that they weren't spending before.
Right.
Longer-term impacts, I think, are a little harder to discern, but they're almost certainly negative. We have a situation now where the our sort of default mode of governing by crisis has imbued a sort of a degree of background uncertainty that's just made it very important to plan, very difficult for businesses to plan. It's raised a level of risk aversion in the markets. You can see that, for example, in higher yields on corporate bonds and so forth. A study by macroeconomic advisors that was released, I think, just in the last week, quantified what this corrosive uncertainty is doing to us. They think it's lowered our growth rate in the last few years by 0.3 percentage points a year and cost us 900,000 jobs that we otherwise would have had. And if, as the pessimists think, we're going to do this all over again a few months from now, it just suggests that that cost will continue to be borne by our economy.
How does that show up? I mean, and what about where how business weighs in here, if they weigh in? I mean, for years, we heard a loud shout out of Washington about uncertainty. Republicans pinned that uncertainty on the Obama administration. But now we've got a new streak of uncertainty, quite a wide one here, and it's got certainly got much more GOP fingerprints on it. Do you see the business community weighing in here to try and change the dynamic, Greg?
Well, they've certainly been trying to make themselves heard over the last few weeks to the Republican caucus. I mean, make no mistake, businesses in general are not terribly happy with the Obama administration. They do believe, with some justification, that there's been upsurge in new rules. The Affordable Care Act adds costs, it adds red tape, it adds bureaucracy. It doesn't take away from the very appropriate purposes of the act, but there's no getting around the fact that businesses aren't crazy about it. But not being crazy about it is different from saying, therefore, shut the government down and make it impossible for us to keep going about our business in order to change the thing. And when the federal government shuts down, businesses find that there's all sorts of little things they really need it for. A beer company that can't launch a new beer because they need the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms to certify something. Mortgage bankers who cannot issue new mortgages because the IRS is unable to verify income. And on a larger level, when, for example, the Federal Aviation Administration does not have multi-year appropriations, it makes it hard for airline companies and cargo companies to install next generation air traffic control. It's not easy to quantify, Tom, but in little ways, big and small, it works its way into the fabric of business planning and costs us in the long run.
And then what about this from one of our listeners? Mark says, and then there, he writes on the website, and then there is the impact of our standing overseas, where you'll see that there are we're pretty much viewed as idiots around the world. President had that forced absence, let China take the lead at the Asia-Pacific Economic Summit. I mean, there's been this talk about we've got to get the United States out of its central position in the economy, at least China talking this up, because it's just not acting like the big responsible leader anymore. Does that have real impact, Greg, or is that just grandstanding?
I think that at this point, a lot of that is more fear than reality. I mean, like it or not, this is kind of the way America was set up with these checks and balances and these passionate ideological battles. Yes, this was the first government shutdown in 17 years, but there have been shutdowns before. And I think that people who know the United States well in other countries kind of roll their eyeballs and say, there go those Americans again. And in some sense, these sorts of battles are the price of having a durable democracy, which has made the United States as prosperous and as strong a leader as it has. That said, when it reaches this level of dysfunction, yes, it has an impact. I mean, it is harder for the president to promise the sorts of things that are necessary to do the deals to bring allies along, whether it's on a geopolitical matter such as containing Iran or an economic matter such as pushing through this Trans-Pacific Partnership. We are not at the point yet where the United States has been eclipsed or displaced by China, because If you go to other countries, yes, they shake their heads and they say, boy, we wish the United States could be a better leader. But they're not yet about to throw their lot in with China, a country whose form of government and whose recent bullying tactics alarms a lot of people. So, no, we have not reached a tipping point where the United States is eclipsed by China. But each time this happens, it makes it a little bit harder to make that case.
Roger Simon, the unease is not only abroad watching this. Susan writes to us on Facebook. She says, for me, the scary lesson is that I don't have confidence anymore that our governmental system works efficiently. I don't know if it ever worked efficiently, Roger, but we have the sense that one way or another it worked. And I wonder about the impact of Americans, long so proud of our own system, losing confidence in that, a system that works.
That, I think, is the great price we have begun to pay. Jay Carney said at the White House briefing yesterday, there are no winners here. The American people paid a price, not just in lost income and inconvenience and not being able to see some national parks, but exactly, Tom, what you said, which is if you lose confidence in your government, then you really become disassociated from the world around you, and you believe things are hopeless, you can't have a functioning democracy if a large percentage of your population doesn't believe in government. There's got to be some government of some size, anarchy is not really a system that's going to work in the United States. And every time we have one of these shutdowns and scares, every time we lurch from crisis to crisis, we lose the confidence of the people.
James in Columbia, South Carolina. James, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. A lot of people are blaming the Republicans for holding America hostage and all this, but I do have to think that President Obama was the author of the continuing resolution through the shutdown of the government, and the Senate has failed to pass a budget. And I would take that as perception as those two bodies of the government are holding American hostage. And also, if you look at the judicial system, Obamacare was judged as constitutional, but if you look at the origin of the bill, the tax bill as it comes out, never originated in the House of Representatives where it should have, therefore it's unconstitutional. So you've got three parts of the government that are holding America hostage, but everybody's blaming the Republicans.
I think we need
to step back and take a look at that.
James, let me ask you, I can feel that sort of, gut-level resistance to a lot of things in the Obama years here. But after what we've just seen, are you prepared to step back a little bit and say, wait a minute, let's settle the boat? Everybody needs to calm down here, or do you still want to, go right at all those policies, James?
Well, I voted for Obama this last election, which I kind of regret a little bit. Hmm. But locally, I voted for some Republicans. I'm an independent person.
Okay.
I try to vote for the person I think that best suits the purpose of myself, my community, and the United States.
Yep.
Okay. But the policies of the president that he's pushing so hard, he's not followed through on some of his promises, and he's failed. He's actually taken the law into his own hand. A law that has passed, he's already taken part out of the law, but then you tell the Republicans you can't mess with a law that's already been published.
James, we've got it. Let me put that to you. There's a lot of sentiment and some points that you may or may not agree on factually, but you hear James' view. What are you thinking as you hear James's critique, which is not hard to find, of this administration?
Well, I would correct the caller briefly. The Senate did pass a budget in March after 4 years of not passing a budget. But beyond the sort of facts of it, I mean, I do think that it is true, and what another caller said previously, that Democrats would love this to be a purely Republican phenomenon in the eyes of the public. But there was already a lot of cynicism out there about Washington in general. There was already a sentiment that it was broken and that politicians weren't doing their jobs. Part of that is the reason Obama got elected in the first place. He said he was going to change things. And if anything, things have gotten worse. And some people do blame him for that, rightly or wrongly. family. So at the same time, what you hear, we've seen a lot of these polls, what you hear from, I watched a focus group of independent voters last night, is these sort of conflicting desires. On the one hand, they want someone who fights for them. They want someone who stands up for what they believe in and doesn't back down. On the other hand, they want compromise. They want people to get along in Washington. They want them to talk. They want them to negotiate and come together. You can't have both of those things. So I think it's a pretty confusing mandate for a lot of leaders in Washington.
Here's what the president himself had to say at his press conference yesterday after the Senate vote.
My hope and expectation is everybody has learned that there's no reason why we can't work on the issues at hand, why we can't disagree between the parties while still being agreeable, and make sure that we're not inflicting harm on the American people when we do have disagreements. So hopefully that's a lesson that will be internalized, and not just by me, but also by Democrats and Republicans.
Greg Ipp, how do you look at this? How do we get to a, you know, a sort of bridgeable gap here rather than an unbridgeable chasm?
Well, you know, maybe I'm the last optimist left in Washington.
Don't be alone. We want to push for that, please.
I think there might be a fighting chance here that we actually can put some of this behind us. I look at Obama and the Republicans like two bloodied boxers who've basically fought themselves to a draw and are trying to find ways to actually get out of the ring. Mm-hmm. I thought it was intriguing that Paul Ryan, who more than anybody else is kind of the intellectual standard bearer of the Republicans, he had an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal a week or two ago, and he said, here's a way forward. There are things that the president and we agree on. Perhaps we can find a way to loosen the sequester. That's this cap on the discretionary spending that's resulted in so many cutbacks. Maybe we can loosen that, increase spending in the near term, and trade that for long-term entitlement reform. Perhaps make the wealthy pay more for Medicare, perhaps alter the rules on Medigap plans to discourage overuse of doctors. And these are things, not coincidentally, that the president himself has proposed.
Would those qualify as the new revenues that the president insists on as part of a grand bargain?
No. That is actually an important omission. Paul Ryan did not talk about offering up new revenues as part of that. And thus far, the president has been adamant that if he's going to give ground on entitlements, there must be new revenues. So it's hard to make too much of this offer because we haven't yet grasped that nettle, which has been essentially what has derailed all previous negotiations. But I guess what I am saying is that if there is a chasm, it's a little bit of a smaller chasm than it was, both substantively in the sense that the Republicans have moved off their extremist positions about wanting Obamacare dismantled and wanting Medicare replaced by vouchers, and in the sense that politically I think both sides have lost a lot, even if the Republicans have lost more over the last few months, and there might be an exhaustion factor that drives them towards wanting to do something.
Roger Simon, I found myself sometimes in the last couple of weeks thinking, you know, this country can't take too much more of this. Do you see a real opportunity or readiness here to turn down the ideology and get practical about the country's problems? Is there enough common ground to even do that on this side of this latest uproar, Roger?
I believe there is. I'll quote the famous British slogan from World War II, keep calm and carry on. We're capable of doing that. There is, I agree with Molly and Greg, that there are certain wide differences between the two parties, but there is also some agreement on the broader points. Both Republicans and Democrats believe that entitlement spending is not sustainable. Our economy simply does not grow fast enough to sustain the increase in spending on entitlements. So we have to do something about it. The driving force for Obamacare, by the way, was to reduce the deficit. Obamacare is supposed to save the government billions of dollars a year.
But the president says, in fairness, get some revenues in here too, because the top of the pyramid is doing just fine, thank you, and the middle and bottom are not.
It's true. There are little things that the Democrats have hinted about, a chained CPI, changing the retirement age for Social Security, even means testing, though I doubt that'll ever happen, which would save the government billions and billions and billions of dollars. And Obama says, Well, you know, if we're going to take money from working people and give it back to the government, shouldn't the super rich and the merely rich pay their fair share? I mean, isn't that basic fairness? And that is where the clash comes from. But you can make certain agreements around the edges of that basic difference.
Molly, we've got all kinds of response here. Adam says, it's time for a second republic. This one no longer works. Wes says, listening to the show, says, we are going to rerun this show on January 15th. Dear Lord, I hope not, Molly. Do we avoid that?
Well, I'm skeptical anything big gets done, but it is certainly possible that we muddle through the way we always have and nobody's happy. That's how government's supposed to work, really.
I'd like to muddle through a little better than that. I think this country deserves it. Maybe, maybe this time. Our thanks to all of you for being with us on the morning, the day after. Molly Ball with The Atlantic, always great to have you. Thanks for your insights, Molly.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Roger Simon, chief political columnist for Politico. Thanks for joining us, Roger.
Thank you, Tom.
And Greg Gipp, you're always terrific, U.S. economics editor for The Economist. Thank you for joining us today, Greg.
Good to talk to you, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm there, too, at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. Heaven help us all. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.